This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars Brotherhood by Mike Chen. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. The Clone Wars have erupted. Caught off guard by the quickly expanding conflict, the overwhelmed Jedi Order has rushed the advancement of Padawans to better integrate into the Grand Army of the Republic and assist the war effort. Newly promoted Jedi Knight Anakin Skywalker is increasingly torn between his growing duties to the Republic and his secret marriage to Senator Padme Amidala of Naboo. With his knighting, his mentor, Obi-Wan Kenobi, has been elevated to the Jedi Council under the rank of Jedi Master. As dark forces push the Jedi further toward their transformation from guardians to soldiers, Anakin and Obi-Wan find themselves on equal footing, yet opposing paths, each pondering the meaning of peace and justice during a time of war. Chapter 1, Rug Quornum. Cato Ne Moidia was a world of mist. High above that mist, cliffs and branches poked through, carved at all angles into immense mountainous spires. The thick stone of the planet's largest rock arches and peaks loomed, casting shadows in a seemingly infinite stretch before being absorbed into the dense vapor below. Between, over, and on top of these natural wonders hung gilded cities with ornate towers and reflective sidings, structures suspended as bridges between massive, colossal ridges. But Cato Ne Moidia did have something beneath all of that, a foundational layer at the base of the thick fog. On normal days, taking the journey from Cato Ne Moidia's bridge cities to the surface meant a gradual descent into an ever-thickening blanket of white. Today, however, was not a normal day, because today, something had gone terribly wrong. And the lower the shuttle flew, the more the milky hue of the mist darkened as harsh streams of blackened ash mixed in. Rug Quornum had seen destruction all her life. As an elite commando of the Ne Moidian Defense Legion, she dealt with explosives and blaster fire, rockets and shrapnel. And death. So much death. Most of it by her own doing, courtesy of the custom sniper rifle that felt like an extension of her own limbs. Murder and destruction. That was her life for so many years, doing the will of her government to carve out a better place for Ne Moidians in the galaxy. Even now, in her new assignment as a royal guard for Cato Ne Moidia's capital city of Zara, her goal remained the same, the protection of her people. Rug had taken the assignment in good faith, even though she knew it had been for questioning the judgment of the Trade Federation, a perspective considered dissent by those who held much more sway than a military grunt. Such good faith was being challenged right now, in a time when the galaxy dared to rip itself in two. "Look at that," said the voice of her young partner next to her. Kitar Nor's mouth opened, holding a thought in limbo as a thick, dull gray began to envelop their craft, visibility coming and going from the cockpit of their patrol ship. "It's worse than I imagined." A steady hand and open eyes. That was the only way to approach this. Not only for the flight to the surface, but to understand just what had occurred and why. The call for all available security to go beneath the mist came so fast that Rug piloted their craft on a direct downward path, leaving the port of a neighboring city and abandoning a scheduled prisoner transfer to plunge through the mist. They hadn't even been informed of what they were investigating, just that an emergency so catastrophic had occurred that everyone within a 200-kilometer radius was requested, no, ordered, to drop their tasks and go. Details filled in over comm chatter. A bomb. No. Several bombs. A building collapsed. No. An entire plaza. No. Despite the speculation on the comms, the reality of the situation became clearer with each passing second. And it was far beyond what anyone could have ever guessed. An entire portion of the bridge city, the neighborhood known as Katasura. Blocks and streets of Neimoidian civilization severed within an instant. The structural supports that fastened the district to the rest of Zara evaporated in a blink. All those people, all that life, dropped straight downward through the mist of Cato Neimoidia to a sudden violent fate. Dirt and rock mashing into alloys and flesh. But why? Cato Neimoidia is neutral, Rug thought. Despite the recent chaos of Geonosis, despite the use of Trade Federation battle droids, the war stayed an arm's length away. Viceroy Newt Gunray led a splinter faction to ally with the Confederacy of Independent Systems. The Trade Federation proper was free from the influence of Count Dooku and his separatist ideals. Senator Lot Dodd made sure of that with his place within the heart of Republic politics. But here on the surface, Rug's eyes told her everything she needed to know. The twisted shrapnel of once elegant structures now reduced to cracked and broken material, scattered into countless pieces. As the shuttle approached, the devastation amplified with each passing second. What appeared as a lump of rubble gradually formed into the jagged debris of buildings and bridges. Closer still, as Rug maneuvered the craft for a flat place to land, details came to life. Not just the destruction of structures, but within the fallen wreckage, bodies. So many bodies of so many ages from so many walks of life. Bodies bent into impossible positions, thrown into places they shouldn't have been due to the chaos of gravity, pulling an entire district to the surface. And through it all, so much smoke. The massive plume of gray from above breaking down into individual currents of black the farther down they went, streams feeding a river of death. Rug stepped out, flecks of ash landing on her dark green skin. And even amid the cool air of the planet's base, heat poked through in every direction from the endless fires entwining in and through and over what used to be mighty structures. Who? Kitar started, swiveling his view all around. He blinked as he took in the horrific possibilities, his mouth open. How? Rug had seen Kitar driven by emotions on the job before. Sometimes anger and sometimes fear. Fear that he tried to hide. But she knew better. It came with an innocence. The type that only shattered after killing someone. For better or worse, such actions calloused over fear, layers thickening with each successive murder. Yet the frozen expression on his face right now displayed his mix of emotions clearly, a grief stemming from a deeper well than he'd ever let on. "Steady, Kitar," she said, moving next to him. From a mound of rubble above, arms waved, along with a cry that someone had been found alive. They need our help. The Republic, Kitar growled, his long fingers bending into a single shaking grip. The Republic did this. They're blaming us for Newt Gunray. We don't know that, and right now it doesn't matter. Which was wrong, of course. The culprit behind this did matter, and whoever they were, they needed to be brought to justice. But there was a time and place for retribution. Focus. They called us here to help people. That's what we need to do. Though Kitar faced the team screaming for help from the top of the rubble, their pleas seemed invisible to him. Instead, he stared blankly ahead, like everything was a hologram glitching in and out. But it wasn't. This was real. Any doubt erased by the harsh burning odors entering her smell glands beneath her eyes. Kitar, Rug said quietly. You're right, he said, suddenly nodding. His demeanor shifted. His catatonia abruptly swapped for a moment with a very swift and direct purpose. The young guard grabbed his bag of medical supplies and ran off, as if a single person with a small case of Bacta and synth flesh might make a difference. Kitar's youth carried an expected naivete, an earnest desire to do right by his people. Rube knew better. An individual had limitations, no matter how dedicated they were. She pulled out a small metallic circle, then clicked a button to generate a holographic map of the region. Around her, other transports landed. Medical personnel, security officers, government officials, and people who simply wanted to help. So many of Rug's fellow Nemoidians zigged and zagged, some lifting up debris, some screaming into comms for help, and some pacing, head buried in hands. Droids of all sizes soared, a mix of small surveillance units flying in between larger rescue droids that dropped extinguishing chemicals fire by fire. No matter which direction she turned, her vision filled with devastation, all on a far greater scale than she could ever remember. She understood Kitar's urge to dash off with Bacta. The feeling that one person might be able to somehow fix all of this. In a way, Kitar was right. They had to start somewhere. Because even though Cato Nemoidia was neutral, it had been gravely wounded. And someone had to pay. But who? Chapter 2. Anakin Skywalker. Anakin Skywalker stood as he always did, feet planted slightly wider than his hips in a balanced stance, arms behind him with his hands clasped at the small of his back. Hand, actually. One of his limbs remained, his organic arm, part of the flesh and blood born of Shmi Skywalker and raised under the unflinching desert suns of Tatooine. The other hand was metal and wire and sensors, a synthetic extension that moved nearly but not quite the way he intended. Not perfect yet, but he was getting better at it. And though the textures of the mechanical replacement were so unnatural that he covered it with a glove, his wife never treated its touch as anything but his own, at least in the short time they were able to be together following his duel with Count Dooku. His wife, where was she right now? Senator Padme Amidala, always meeting with people or talking with people or talking about people. She'd returned to Coruscant and was likely heading to the Senate District, a single beacon of hope, dashing somewhere through this massive structure of a planet. Anakin closed his eyes while Jedi Master Mace Windu continued to talk to the assembled, the latest group of recently promoted Jedi Knights. For 1,000 generations, the Jedi had their traditions of trials and ceremony, of ascending rank and recognizing achievement. But that was before Geonosis, before the Clone Wars started, before an oath to be peacekeepers somehow evolved overnight into roles as soldiers and commanders, an overlap the clones themselves couldn't quite comprehend, leading to the informal title of General on the battlefield. Anakin had always imagined his knighting to be a significant life milestone, a sea change in his heart and mind. Enough time had passed since the official transition that his once short hair had started to grow out, and now this ceremony felt more like a procedural step, a footnote to go along with the bigger issues facing the galaxy. This gathering, filled with ceremony in the shadow of the Jedi Temple training courtyard, seemed simply unimportant. So much so that an urge tugged at Anakin to go, to fast forward the cadence of the galaxy itself so he could finally reunite with his wife tonight. He had, after all, a keepsake to deliver within the small pouch buckled to his belt. Master Windu walked the perimeter of the courtyard under the shadow of the great tree, Anakin standing with the rest of the new Jedi Knights, while behind them, current Padawans observed. To his left, Durbin Wen Herd, the Thalothian notable throughout training for her twin Shoto lightsabers. To his right, Keir Stenwit, Olana Chian, and several others. Across the courtyard stood their mentors, at least the ones available. Morag Bomo, a Keldor with black tunic and blue-tinted goggles, Siri Tachi, Madok Risto, and more. And of course, Obi-Wan Kenobi, the newest member of the Jedi Council. Sort of. After the loss of Colman Trabor at Geonosis, various Jedi rotated into his council position. No one would say if this method was permanent, or if the rotations were simply temporary assignments, something born out of the necessity given the push and pull of the war. Either way, the Council had recently picked Obi-Wan for a rotation. In turn, Obi-Wan approached every task with his usual seriousness, even treating this glorified speech like a war decision. Anakin didn't need the Force to feel the weight of his former master's stare. Behind his back, Anakin's fingers balled into fists, the SynthNet neural interface of the Mechno arm reacting the same way as his real hand did, and yet it didn't. Just as with his organic hand, the mechanical fingers pressed in frustration, but no emotion came from the gesture on that side. No tiny ripple through the Force to yet again give away his feelings to Obi-Wan. It was merely a limb. Functional, even stronger than flesh and bone, but not a true part of him. "You are Jedi Knights," Master Windu's voice boomed out as he paced back and forth, as if to call any waning attention back to his intimidating form. "Responsibility, peace, discipline. You are the examples the galaxy looks to. Your successes will carry through the Republic and beyond. As will your mistakes. Your choices will matter, helping the Jedi maintain order during a time of discord." The Master paused, his lips pursed in thought. Anakin figured Mace had given a form of this speech several times now since Geonosis, but perhaps this time he tried his hand at improvisation. "The younglings look up to you. Your choices matter to them. And some of you will receive Padawans of your own. Your choices." Mace enunciated each word with heightened diction. "Will matter to them as well." The thought caused Anakin's lip to curl up ever so slightly. A Padawan? For him? That sounded like the worst thing in the galaxy. And as if on cue, his eyes caught Obi-Wan looking directly at him. Of course, Obi-Wan saw his smirk. Anakin forced his expression back to neutral. then adjusted his posture, pushing his chest out and chin up to uphold Jedi formality. If he had been speaking, his voice would have reverted to the formal monotone he always used around Elder Jedi.
We are at war. This is unprecedented within our lifetimes,
Mace continued.
And you are among the first to reach knighthood during this time of war. Remember that war is like a fire across the galaxy. It spreads and it consumes. We must never waver in the face of that fire. We are keepers of the peace. We are Jedi. The Republic needs us more than ever, which means our faith in the Force, our connection to the Force, must never waver.
Though Mace's face remained stoic and cold, Anakin detected the most unexpected shift coming from him. A single drop in the ocean of the Force. But it rippled outward, and while most probably didn't notice it, Anakin had always found his senses tuned into emotions at a far deeper level than others. Maybe because he actually let himself feel emotions. He reached into the Force for a further understanding of this strange deviation. Was that concern from Mace Windu? But the ripple passed, evaporating as would happen with any Jedi and their emotions. Anakin wanted to shake his head, figuring the moment was nothing more than an extension of Mace's constant disdain for his being there, his very existence. From the moment Qui-Gon Jinn presented Anakin to the debriefing after Geonosis, Master Windu always seemed irked by his presence, like he should not have even been there. One time, Anakin caught his look when fellow Padawans mentioned the Chosen One prophecy, in jest, of course, and the power of his instant glare felt more deadly than his renowned fighting technique. Anakin rubbed him the wrong way. He always had, and this was probably just another example. Anakin reminded himself to be bigger than that petty moment and push it aside. He took in a breath, and though his eyes tracked Mace during the rest of the speech, his mind wandered to his childhood. The ceremony played out as the opposite of those Tatooine nights when the desert chill would work its way through the cracks of their worn-down home. Rather than the cold, grand speech amid the Jedi Temple's exquisite designs, he thought of his mother, retelling a story for the umpteenth time in their small hovel. The warmth of her hand enough to reassure his whole body and mind. The Sun Dragon lives inside a star, guarding everything it loves and treasures, she would say, as she had done so many times throughout his childhood. Generations of Tatooine dwellers heard the same story told with their own family variations, but his mother's version carried the most feeling. Appropriate for a myth about heart. It guarded them through the fire and flame, always keeping them safe. It could persevere through anything, even life within a star itself, because the Sun Dragon has the biggest heart in the galaxy. A furnace of flames powerful enough to protect everything and everyone it loves. The strongest heart, stronger than the heart of a star. She told Anakin this story dozens, possibly hundreds of times when he was growing up, usually after he'd gotten into an argument with Kitster, or Watto was unnecessarily cruel, or one of his inventions exploded in his face. He could see her expression now, the way her smile brought lines to frame her mouth, the way her eyes never judged, the way stray hairs fell across her forehead after a long day. Those were the moments she'd always squeeze his hand and look him straight in the eye. You are the Sun Dragon. You have the strongest heart. Always believe in it. Suddenly, the loving face of Shmi Skywalker disappeared from Anakin's mind's eye, replaced with the blistering cool of night, the flicker of flame, the cries of sand people, the smell of blood. All through these thoughts, he stood stoic alongside his fellow Jedi Knights, fighting to keep his feelings at bay. Another memory arrived with a surprise, one that draped calm over the open wounds of Tatooine. It echoed, a feeling as real as the moment it first happened. The strong hands of Qui-Gon Jinn on his shoulders, his soothing words whispering in his ears. It wasn't the first time he'd felt the presence of the fallen Jedi. Whether a flash of deep memory or one of the Force's great tricks in his favor, the presence always re-centered him in a way that Obi-Wan's lectures never did. "It is your time to serve the galaxy and the Republic," Mace said. "May the Force be with you." The group began clapping as Mace walked off without hesitation to take his place next to Master Yoda. Obi-Wan looked around the courtyard, then back at the other masters. They all exchanged glances, and Anakin caught a rare moment of confusion from his old teacher. Obi-Wan, able to negotiate and improvise his way out of anything with grace and tact, now stood flustered because of an apparent scheduling problem. "This is Obi-Wan Kenobi," Anakin thought with an amused sigh, frustrated by protocol and formalities in a time of war. He watched as Obi-Wan ran his fingers through his hair, thick locks flowing to his shoulders, having grown even longer since Geonosis.
"Well, it appears that our guests are a little late," he said, stepping in front of the group.
By guests, he referred to Chancellor Palpatine, various senators, and a few of the clone commanders who happened to be on planet. A mixture of ceremony and duty for each of them.
"I'm certain they will be here soon. In the meantime..."
An electronic chirp rang through the space, something urgent enough for Yoda to wave his hand at the control panel for holo communications at the far wall. Palpatine did appear, but as a hologram floating in the middle of the courtyard rather than in person. And instead of a 2-minute cursory speech about duty, the Chancellor addressed Yoda and Mei specifically, not the gathered invitees.
"Master Yoda, Master Windu, we have urgent news that is sure to impact the war effort. Cato Nain Mordia has been bombed."
Yoda and Mace looked at each other, only their eyes moving. Obi-Wan had a slightly more animated response, at least for a seasoned Jedi. A small inhale, then a hand up to his beard. The others reacted within the range of those extremes, though the air itself shifted. Yoda tapped his stick.
"Padawans and younglings, this discussion they do not need. To further study, they should go."
Obi-Wan moved over to gather, then direct them out, and Anakin took a reflexive step forward until he felt a hand on his shoulder. Obi-Wan spoke, his voice gentler than his usual redirections of Anakin's instincts.
"Not you. You are a Jedi Knight now, remember?"
He looked over to the Padawans, who had started to leave.
"We are equals,"
he said with a slight and forced smile beneath his beard. Anakin wondered if the gesture's awkward nature was because of the dire circumstance about Cato Nain Mordia, or if his old master simply hadn't gotten used to seeing Anakin as something other than an apprentice.
"Do I still have to call you Master?"
he asked, more bite to his question than it should have had. A flush came to Anakin's cheeks, betraying the muscle memory that wanted to argue with Obi-Wan about rules and fairness, no matter what the situation.
"Only if you know your place,"
Obi-Wan replied, but this time his smile gave off a genuine glow, almost amusement at their old push-and-pull relationship. The courtyard cleared of Padawans. The Jedi now gathered in front of the holographic figure of the most powerful man in the Republic.
"Bombed," Mace asked Palpatine. How bad? By whom?
Intelligence is still coming in, but early reports indicate the scope is a larger catastrophe than Cato Neimoidia has seen in recorded history. It is...
A clone commander faded into view.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Chancellor, but we have further details.
Palpatine nodded and the clone continued.
It appears an entire segment of the capital city of Zara has been severed from the foundational struts. It has completely collapsed.
Chapter 3. Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Obi-Wan stood side by side with his former Padawan, just as they'd done many times over the past decade, and yet, this was different. This felt different. Together, they watched the holos of Palpatine and the clone commander flicker, alongside intercepted security recordings from Cato Neimoidia that lacked enough clarity to fully define the scope of the devastation. But for several seconds, Obi-Wan ignored galactic catastrophes and instead thought of Anakin, who stood quiet with arms behind his back, his usual commanding stance with intense eyes taking in the unfolding conflict. A powerful Jedi, an intense heart, an uncontrollable impulse, all of these things were central to Anakin's being. And now an equal, his Padawan braid severed. But more than the symbolism of his braid, Anakin's emotional transition to Jedi Knight was proving rougher than Obi-Wan expected. Rather than a simple flick of a mental switch, Anakin seemed to take several steps forward toward confident decision-making before skirting back into deference. Anakin Skywalker seemed unsure of where his place was, which was quite unlike him, given all of the arguing they'd done for years, all those times Anakin insisted he was right. Perhaps the war muddied those waters. He thought back to his own early days. His ascension into Jedi knighthood counterbalanced by the loss of Qui-Gon Jinn. And while his peers seemed to take their promotions in stride, his own circumstances created so many stumbling blocks. How long did it take for him to feel like he'd earned the title? And now that he was given an opportunity to sit on the Jedi Council, how could his input possibly carry the same insight and weight as that of more experienced Jedi Masters? A memory fluttered through Obi-Wan's mind, an exchange with his former master he hadn't thought of in nearly a decade. "Don't center on your anxieties." Obi-Wan exhaled and felt the ground beneath his feet returning to the here and now.
"Early estimates put the death toll at 4,000, based on daily traffic of the Katasura district,"
the clone said.
"The bridge held important political targets, including the Trade Federation licensing office. But it also housed an arts district with numerous commercial buildings. I'm afraid the civilian casualty toll is high."
Palpatine's holographic visage flickered as the Chancellor frowned.
"Understood. Thank you for the report, Commander."
Yoda stepped forward.
"Neutral. Cato Neimoidia is. No reason for military targeting. Work with all sides. The Trade Federation does."
Obi-Wan considered the recent tactical report he'd seen on the Splinter faction led by Newt Gunray, one that Lot Dodd claimed was completely disconnected from the Trade Federation. Has Senator Dodd been informed? Palpatine nodded.
"He is just outside of communication range. But as I understand it, he is aware of the situation."
Yoda's stick tapped on the floor.
"Insight our new Jedi Knights have?"
Obi-Wan caught Anakin's eyes dropping, as well as the short inhale that he quickly swallowed.
"Could loyalists from the Republic have guerrilla fighters who went rogue?"
Kirstenwood said, and though her voice projected confidence, she glanced at her mentor, Modok Risto, who offered a subtle nod in return.
"Bounty hunters,"
Durbin Wen Hurd offered.
War always drives their economics. It could be a coordinated effort to create demand for their services.
Perhaps,
Yoda said.
Perhaps a true accident this is.
A separatist trick. Anakin finally interjected, the gravity of seriousness in his voice. A ploy to gain sympathies. The Nemoidians are unscrupulous cowards. The judgment in his voice caught Obi-Wan's attention. Though given his long, volatile history with them, it wasn't that surprising. That seems counterproductive, even for Newt Gunray. He would not sacrifice a civilian population of his own people, Mace said, his glare strong enough for Obi-Wan to feel from several meters away. Anakin inhaled to retort, but then caught eyes with Obi-Wan again, and that mere threat of connection seemed to be enough to halt the young Jedi's impulses. Yoda shook his head, his ears trembling with the movement.
Possibilities war has created,
the old Jedi Master said, a rare disgust in his words.
Points of view distorted. The scope of the Clone Wars, beyond the peacekeeping tradition of the Jedi.
Anakin straightened, turning back to the hologram of Palpatine, who looked off to the side before nodding and continuing.
Count Dooku appears to be making a statement right now.
And with that, the fallen Jedi appeared alone, his regal maroon cape draped over his shoulders as he stood in what was apparently a small office in his Sereno home. The feed caught him in mid-sentence, though his tone and words quickly filled in the blanks.
Act of terrorism. As the primary representative of the Confederacy of Independent Systems, I assure the Trade Federation and the citizens of Cato Nemordia that we have no involvement in such senseless violence. We condemn such things, and our relationship with the Trade Federation is, as it has always been, merely transactional in nature. However, we make no secret that Viceroy Newt Gunray and his associates are key officials of our movement.
Emotion surged from Anakin, a tangible wave at the mention of the Trade Federation Viceroy. Obi-Wan observed his former apprentice from the way his shoulders locked to the tightening of his jaw, a tension that came and went quickly, but not as quick as most Jedi.
I think the evidence is clear. The Republic targeted Newt Gunray, who was visiting the Katasura district a mere hour before the bombing. Had the Viceroy stopped to enjoy the cuisine of his people, or to take in the local museum to immerse himself in the culture he dearly misses, he would have been killed.
Dooku straightened, his unblinking eyes looking straight into the cam, piercing the distance from Sereno to Coruscant.
But despite this mountain of evidence against the Republic, I am nothing if not honorable. I invite the Republic to explain this action. I will stay away to avoid any perception of conflict. After all, the Trade Federation is a neutral entity and should be allowed to pass judgment using their own system of justice. For the Republic to truly be open to discussion of such a catastrophic event, it seems only right that Chancellor Palpatine himself go to Cato Nemordia.
The mere suggestion caused a ripple through the space, from Anakin's suddenly tensed fist to Mace's furrowed brow. Next to Dooku's hologram, Palpatine's translucent image flickered, though the shock on his face broadcast clearly to all watching.
Such an action would be a remarkable gesture,
Dooku said with a smile.
In the name of transparency.
Yoda turned as Dooku's feed broke apart, the Count of Sereno's image quickly disappearing.
Discuss this further, we will. Facts must be gathered. The Senate we need.
No,
Palpatine said, his mouth weary.
There is no time for Senate deliberation. I will go. I must leave as soon as possible. Every second counts. Without my presence, Dooku may sway the Trade Federation's allegiances to the Separatists. They are far too important a galactic power to let that happen.
I'll go with you, Anakin said. A clone battalion, if he goes, Mace said. The Chancellor needs the highest levels of security.
Palpatine? Flying off to the scene of a disaster on a neutral world? Not just a neutral world, but the crown jewel of the Trade Federation. The same organization with ties to Newt Gunray? Obi-Wan shook his head. And in a rare moment of letting his impulses break through, he spoke without a fully considered plan.
Chancellor, you must not go. It's a trap. Dooku is playing us.
All eyes suddenly turned to Obi-Wan, and now he had to coalesce those impulses into clear thoughts, with the fate of the galaxy at stake. Dooku wants you arriving in a hostile environment, a no-win situation. Think about the optics. This planet is in a state of shock. Its people are mourning. If the Chancellor arrives with troops and Jedi and a fleet, it will at best heighten tensions. At worst, it could lead to violence, all while leaving him vulnerable to sabotage.
Master Kenobi, I understand your concerns, but this is a risk I must take.
Palpatine said, a solemn gravel to his voice.
I will do anything to put a swift end to this war.
Obi-Wan shook his head again, mind sprinting for a solution that would pull Palpatine back from immediate departure.
A lone Jedi. A single emissary with a small crew of scientists and investigators, representing the good faith of the Republic.
As Palpatine's eyebrow arched up, Yoda let out an audible,
It is the best balance of diplomacy, transparency, and investigation. A Jedi has the training to uncover the truth, the autonomy to make decisions, the abilities to move quickly, and the authority to represent the Republic.
Obi-Wan said, the words coming out so rapidly that he needed a large breath.
We are peacekeepers. Even the Trade Federation knows that.
Peacekeepers,
Palpatine said, a slight smile to his lips.
I am not entirely convinced this will work. However, the logistics of my sudden departure will, unfortunately, require a day to sort out. Master Kenobi, if you can convince the Cato Neimoidian government and the Trade Federation before that, then I will concede to you.
One day,
Obi-Wan nodded, then looked around the courtyard. Palpatine, Yoda, Mace Windu, Anakin. They all watched him.
I will come up with a strategy to present within one day.
In the meantime, Mace said, we will discuss potential security measures for the Chancellor with the Senate. We must be prepared for both paths.
Palpatine looked off cam again, then spoke a few inaudible words.
I have further issues to attend to, but I look forward to your findings, Master Kenobi. We must move quickly.
The Katasura disaster stole the gathering sense of ceremony, though when the meeting adjourned, Obi-Wan had hoped to express his pride to Anakin. And given the importance of the milestone, he'd figured his old Padawan would have wanted to have a moment together. But Anakin left so fast that Obi-Wan only caught the blur of his dark cloak on the way out. Thoughts stirred in his mind. War commitments keeping their relationship distant in the short span following the promotion. He'd held on to so many questions for Anakin, waiting for a quiet moment. Was his new arm working for him? Did he have any questions about the responsibilities that came with becoming a Jedi Knight? What really happened on Tatooine? But between the rapidly changing intel on the separatist insurgencies and the sheer chaos of synthesizing military battalions into the long-standing traditions of the Jedi Order, Obi-Wan and Anakin barely had time to breathe, let alone have a talk. Obi-Wan followed the trail of his former apprentice, hustling from the courtyard to the interior, then down the steps over to one of the Jedi Temple's wide hallways. He kept pace, though he never got too close, a range that put him in plain sight, just in case Anakin decided to slow down and turn around. But when it became clear that Anakin's pace was actually increasing, he reminded himself to let go of that personal desire to catch up. Anakin would come find him when he was good and ready. Besides, the catastrophe on Cato Ne Moria remained his top priority, and the fallout from it meant all sorts of complications, not just for the Jedi, but for every system, faction, and government somehow connected to the war. He just had to find a way to start untangling it all. Obi-Wan was about to break left toward the stairway leading to the Jedi Archives when he saw Anakin pause down the hall. Despite the distance, he recognized Anakin's body language, and the shift proved massive enough that it stole Obi-Wan's thoughts from the war. Anakin, so bold in his determination, usually walked with his weight carrying him forward, nearly leaning ahead as if he were chasing the future. But here Anakin stopped, and his entire body softened, from the way he held his shoulders to the way his arms hung. His head turned, waiting, and Anakin's smile grew so large that Obi-Wan saw it across the hall. Then he understood why. Dashing across to meet him was Padme Amidala, trailed by a handmaiden and one of Naboo's security, a woman Obi-Wan recognized as Mariek Panaka. The senator marched directly, wearing a flowing maroon dress with dark navy trim, a simple bronze headpiece holding her hair tightly in a bun. She took even and controlled steps, presenting the opposite of Anakin's hurried gait, but the same straight path, like magnets hurtling through space to lock into each other. He'd heard Padme had been visiting the capital planet on Senate business for a few days, though all senators had been in Coruscant more often than not in the weeks following Geonosis. As much as the Jedi shuffled around the galaxy these days, senators seemingly had withdrawn to the core, dealing with the hows and whys of a potential civil war while the Jedi commanded clone troopers. Padme's proximity wasn't much of a surprise, but her stop at the Jedi Temple was a little out of the norm. Unless she planned on attending the courtyard ceremony for the newly promoted Jedi Knights. It may have been as simple as that, given her history with Anakin. A show of respect and gratitude, something thrown off course by the news of Cato Ne Moria. As for Anakin, well, Obi-Wan had known of his former Padawan's infatuation with the senator for a while now. He understood, having handled his own youthful brush with temptation, one of the few things that still made him equally chuckle and groan when he thought of it. At least, until he let the memories drift away into the distance, knowing they'd float back ashore at some point. But here, Anakin's greeting, though stilted and formal, rippled a wave of emotion through the Force. A very specific frequency that Obi-Wan recognized as everything he knew about Anakin consolidated into a flash. Curiosity, adoration, joy, anxiety, fear. All of those rippled off Anakin. But above all came something far more dangerous. Passion.
And passion was a liability even during normal Jedi operations, but infinitely more so in the context of war. He expected the senator to go on her way, a short greeting before official business. He also expected Anakin to hesitate a second too long. That boyish infatuation, pulling his attention more than it should before his sense of duty returned. Instead, they stood there, a careful distance apart to be sure, but something was markedly different here. Not that long ago, Padme had practically brushed Anakin aside when they'd arrived in her apartment following the assassination attempt right before Geonosis. Yet here, though they held an air of formality between them, they clearly engaged with each other. The senator, known for giving impassioned speeches, for her sharp observational skills, for her ability to find a constructive path forward, was lingering to talk with a Jedi known for never slowing down, whether in a speeder or on foot or by any other means. But there they were, talking politely, smiling at each other. Padme even took a quick glance around her, a subtle move that no one would notice up close, but it clearly stood out from above. Especially because for the briefest of moments, her bodyguard looked off at something in the distance. She reached up, a quick touch at the spot behind his ear where his Padawan braid had been. And then, as if the gesture flipped a switch in her, Padme's pose tightened, her chest and shoulders suddenly taller, despite her small frame. Anakin, too, reacted, but not with the expected embarrassment from such a close interaction with the object of one's infatuation, but rather a scan to either side, similar to Padme's, yet nowhere near as subtle. He soon matched her, returning to a strong stance. Though he towered over her in height, the air of softness surrounded him, and another short conversation passed, words too quiet for even a dedicated observer to pick up. Despite this turn to buckled-down formality, Anakin's bare emotions continued rippling outward. Even as they parted ways, Anakin's feelings left a wake in the Force, a clear silhouette of his presence, something that probably only Obi-Wan would recognize. Far too often, Anakin let his emotions dictate the situation, the tempering from Jedi training working only as a leash to the impulses that still ruled his actions. But anything that let a Jedi's guard down for even a moment put the Republic at risk, especially one as powerful as Anakin Skywalker. Especially one prophesied to be the chosen one, to bring balance to the Force. And Padme, rather than dismissing it as she'd done in her apartment not too long ago, had amplified their connection. What to make of all of this? She was letting Anakin indulge in his infatuation, though to what degree Obi-Wan couldn't tell. But there was more to it. And Obi-Wan wasn't sure if he wanted to know where it led. Oh. The short word escaped him, an expression as unexpected as what he'd just witnessed. He continued watching Anakin, who took a moment to gather himself before stopping to talk with Jaro T'Pol and the red-haired youngling who trailed him. And though they talked longer than he did with the senator, no similar feelings projected from him. Not in Anakin's body language, nor in his connection to the Force.
Oh, hello, Master Kenobi, Padme said with a quick wave. Is the Chancellor still here?
Obi-Wan must have been so lost in watching Anakin that he completely missed Padme making her way up the stairs to his location. She stood still, and both her handmaiden and her bodyguard waited equally spaced from her. Nearly a precise triangle formation. He nodded to greet the trio, then considered how to answer.
He attended the ceremony by holoconference, but the topic changed quickly. Because of Cato Ne Moidia?
because of Cato Nemoidia.
Thank you, she said, a simple and efficient acknowledgement. Obi-Wan gave another quick nod, still in the same spot as she moved quickly past to connect with Senator Bail Organa across the hallway. It seemed that many senators were suddenly interested in visiting the Jedi Temple. But galactic disaster would do that, especially when Count Dooku publicly goaded the Republic into sending someone to the site of the bombing, possibly even its leader. Obi-Wan shook the mixture of doubts and concerns from his mind. The question of Anakin's motives pulling him away from the task at hand, though he reminded himself that something like this might not resolve immediately, or could resolve on its own. It might even require a conversation with Anakin. But right now, the Republic was at war. The Jedi had to intervene. And if he wanted to prevent Palpatine from falling into Dooku's trap, he needed to convince Cato Nemoidia to accept a Jedi emissary rather than the Chancellor. Obi-Wan let go of his feelings and started toward the Jedi Archives.
Chapter 4, Anakin Skywalker.
Anakin had seen this before. In fact, so many times. The backdrop was always different. In some cases, under the overwhelming harsh suns of Tatooine skies, and in other cases, in the deep vacuum of space. The experience, though, that always remained true. Speed, lights, obstacles, turns and G-forces. Whether in a pod racer, in a Jedi starfighter, or zipping between buildings on a speeder. Or here, where a few Republic credits to a group known only as the Family gained access to speeder racetracks through abandoned sectors of Coruscant's underworld. Now nothing but industrial fossils, structures and piping and lights that blinked for decades and would probably blink long after the war ended. Paying to use a Family track during a non-race night was something Anakin dreamed about ever since hearing rumors of their existence. And though somewhere out in the stretches of space, clone battalions fought battle droids and emergency medical personnel tried to save lives on Cato Nemoidia, for one night, Anakin shut it all out to be with his wife. His wife. Such a thought, such a definition still seemed unreal to him. Though it felt like another lifetime, only recently, Padme had been a near stranger. Someone he'd catch glimpses of as she moved in and around Coruscant or on the Holonet. He'd dreamed of her. Then he'd tried to push those dreams aside. And then Naboo happened, and Geonosis, and Tatooine. Now, married. They'd barely seen each other since that secret ceremony and their short few days stolen away together. The duties of a Jedi and a politician pulling them all over the galaxy, leaving their marriage mostly as a spiritual bond. They'd send encrypted transmissions whenever possible, their conversations timed against the unpredictable formalities of war and duty. But even then, he felt like their relationship was a dream, the most impossible and wonderful dream. Except she came back to him. Or he came back to her. Not just hollows expressing how desperately they missed each other, but tangible feelings and real touches that made it all not a dream. And that amplified everything in him, making every moment even more precious, all of the good and bad held tightly as if they were the only things that mattered, even in a time of war. Yet in this speeder, as they hurtled through the depths of Coruscant on a highly illegal and very dangerous makeshift course, this was supposed to be their first time together since he achieved the rank of Jedi Knight. Their chance meeting in the Jedi Temple caught him off guard, and it took all of his discipline to not throw his arms around her, to freeze the time and space around them so he could feel the weight of her body against his. But tonight,
Though he'd claimed to take a walk to focus his thoughts, the truth was he and Padme had planned ahead for this. Not just a few evenings out together when their time overlapped on their capital planet, but in the lower levels, where no one would care enough to notice them. A place where they pledged to not talk about politics or the war. Or Kadone Moidia. Though she'd agreed to this activity and paid for the speeder rental, it became clear as Anakin pushed the throttle forward into a near vertical dive that she didn't live and breathe speed the same way he did, even though she had some piloting experience herself.
I should have sent Dorme for this,
she yelled over the whipping wind, her cowl blowing off her hair. Had she come out in any of her usual embellished stylings, the sheer velocity of the joyride would have ripped it all apart. But here she wore an unassuming outfit. Dark trousers and a muted green cowl that easily blended in with the surroundings. And it matched his own. A simple mechanic's coat draped over his Jedi tunic to give the appearance of an everyday laborer and not a Jedi knight. Anakin hit the final turn, easing up on the throttle to make the back end drift. The angle of their glide providing momentum so that a quick burst of the speeder's booster fired them just through the narrow space.
I'm taking it easy,
he said with a laugh, a final drop over the ledge that earned a scream-turned laugh from Padme before slamming the vertical boosters, cushioning their descent like a floating cloud made of metal and wire and alloys. Like his arm. Anakin pushed the thought aside, then reached into the Force with his senses, like sonar through the ether, to identify where the path narrowed and twisted, even where previous racers lost control and crashed. He hit the brakes to drift into a twist, a series of controlled flips and dives, before finally breaking past the uncontested finish line. The speeder stopped, both Anakin and Padme lurching forward before slamming back into the seats.
Woo!
He said, before looking at his wife. This was Padme Amidala, who stared down certain death on Geonosis and charged forward with a blaster to reclaim her planet from Newt Gunray, yet here was breathing heavily with wide eyes and a hand across her chest.
I'm so sorry, Anakin started. Are you okay? Was that too much? Was I...
Sudden laughter echoed out into the industrial bones around them.
Anakin!
She said, her voice broken up by the laughter before she playfully smacked him across the shoulder.
That was exhilarating. And I never want to do it again.
He joined her in laughter, then leaned over, bringing them face to face. She reached out and took his hand, his mechanical hand. The same way she'd held it during their wedding ceremony. Her eyes broke, looking down at the interlace between her fingers and his black glove. The pressure of her hold translated from electric synapses into the nerve endings on the remaining stump of his organic arm. Not too long ago, a mere look from her would make the hairs on that arm stand on end. Now such a thing was impossible. He squeezed her hand back. The microsecond of difference in sensation between his natural movement and this mechanical replacement still throwing him off. Different from combat or illegal racing, where pure instinct and the enhanced sensory intake of the Force tried to compensate. But here, in a quiet moment with his wife, at the start of a marriage as sudden as the replacement of his arm, a microsecond felt like hours. This doesn't bother me. Padme said, placing her other hand over his glove. It never will.
I know. It's just not something I'm totally used to yet. It's part of you.
Besides, she offered a smaller, more intimate laugh than seconds earlier. You drove the speeder just fine. She leaned forward, pressing her lips against his. Sensations he burned for during all those hours on cruisers and shuttles, when the hum of a lightsaber and the chatter of clone commanders stole his attention. He leaned into her, their hands releasing to roam elsewhere, leaving them in a timeless space where only they existed. Until the mechanized voice of a droid interrupted.
The family appreciates your business,
said BS-1119, the bouncer droid that looked a lot like a reconfigured HK assassin unit. Anakin looked up to see it approaching, twin pistols hanging from holsters bolted onto its mechanical hips, and a single pointing finger indicating that they should leave. Despite its threatening demeanor, the droid came off as overtly polite, probably a quirk of a program balancing security and business needs.
You are welcome to schedule another practice ride through one of the family's industrial courses. In addition, bets are open for upcoming races.
From beyond, floating law enforcement droids scanned, and BS-1119 flipped a switch on a nearby control panel on a nondescript wall.
This track is closed. Please pilot your vehicle elsewhere. You must leave now.
It'd probably be in bad taste for a senator and Jedi to be caught down here, Anakin said. Padme grinned and sat back in her seat.
Let's grab something to eat instead of getting arrested.
Husband and wife. What a strange thought. Despite their marriage, their lives had prevented them from living as such. What with Padme handling things like the situation with Heeb Kerr Minor, and Anakin bouncing around the galaxy performing as a mix of warrior, guard, medic, and delivery person. Married couples did things like take walks, go shopping, have dinner. Not fight a war or negotiate peace and then collide for several hours because their schedules allowed for it. A sudden frustration burned within Anakin, lashing at the galaxy for keeping them apart. But even their joyride a few moments ago acted as a reminder. His body, his mind, his heart were committed to a life of adventure, as much as a life with her. Perhaps if Qui-Gon had never found him on Tatooine, he would be on the pod racer circuit now, or have found a life with some other dangerous recreation. Would his mother still be there in that life? But that question led to a dark path of further questions. He buried it deep, locking that night away and reminding himself that he was here with Padme, in a strange life that intermixed combat and justice with quiet moments as husband and wife. He just wished he could pick and choose when each occurred.
I don't think you need a disguise, Padme said, her weight leaning into him as they walked forward into the marketplace. Without your Padawan braid, no one's going to recognize you.
Oh, it always got in the way. I don't miss it. Did I tell you when a stray blaster bolt singed it? That moment from earlier today at the Jedi Temple, when she'd reached up and touched the spot where it had once hung behind his ear? They'd seen each other over Hollow recently, but that unexpected moment was like the Force challenging them to put on their best fronts. Anakin caught her scanning around before making the move. Then the tilted smile that sneaked through, a private acknowledgement that they were pushing the boundaries of their existence in the place with the highest of risks. It made him burn for her even more.
I'm actually going to miss your short hair,
she said, reaching over to run her hand through hair that had started to grow past the standard Padawan trim.
It was always so nice and neat.
Maybe I'll just grow it out to annoy you.
Have you seen how Obi-Wan's hair flows in the back?
He asked. No, please, anything but that, she said, prompting both of them to break into laughter. He'd heard that the underworld's residents were too mired in their own circumstances to be aware of the greater conflicts of the galaxy, and right now, he understood it. With the layers of structures too dense to reveal the sun, life felt encapsulated in a bubble here. In some cases, that might be claustrophobic. But right now, it meant nothing could touch their existence. Not war, not politics, not the rules of the Jedi. They could just be, because this was as close to those moments by the lake on Naboo as they were going to get for now. They walked amid the glowing neon, a mix of signage and cheap, functional illumination. Silence suddenly as natural as breathing. He soaked in the easy joys of just existing next to each other, without guards or hollows or fear that something would pull one of them away. They made it to their destination, a large arching sign proclaiming Amandasi Market, a place that even the more cultured among Coruscant surface dwellers would brave for a more authentic culinary experience. Rows of stalls and a few deactivated transport speeders stood, each offering a different level of messy but authentic delicacies from all over the galaxy. Yet even in this context, where they had the space to simply be and enjoy each other's company, he saw that she still observed. It came in the smallest of personal ticks, the way her inhale quickened, the way her eyebrow rose, the way her head turned to change her angle ever so slightly. He saw the marketplace, a confluence of individual culture and industrial underbelly. But he knew her mind. While she saw all that as well, Padme framed everything within the specific circumstances of who she was. Not just the cook at the grill, but how a child was at his feet. Not just the artist selling wares, but how the size of her bag showed that she didn't have a permanent home. Not just the masseuse working on a client on a chair, but how the masseuse had supported the broken chair with additional spare parts instead of simply purchasing a new one. These details escaped Anakin, at least until he tried to process things the way his wife did. The Jedi were selfless, giving themselves to an order committed to intergalactic peace. But Padme was selfless in a much different way, an empathy that drilled down to the well-being of whoever she encountered, something tempered with a drive to constructively find a way to fix it. Passion tempered by calculated action, the opposite of Anakin's own son Dragonheart. They paused, Padme pulling back her cowl and kneeling down to smell the flowers sticking out of a small vendor cart. And even then, he knew she considered the vendor's situation, from the creakiness of the old droid watering the bouquets to the flower stand that had been clearly rewelded so many times it sagged. Perhaps that was why they were meant for each other. Anakin acted like a fiery burst against injustice, while Padme brought a relentlessness to any situation, a constant search for a solution, even in the most dire of circumstances. Passion and purpose locked together forever in a delicate balance. What do you think? Padme asked, putting a purple flower with glowing teal crystals over her ear. I thought we were staying inconspicuous. You, she said, tucking a matching flower into the breast pocket of his coat, are not a Jedi Knight, and I am not a senator. We're just a married couple having dinner. She gestured around, and he noticed that several other couples had donned matching flowers as well. Of course she would scout this out first. Yeah, he said, locking elbows with her. Just like any other married couple. She rested her head on his shoulder, the glow of her flower tinting her face. Passion and purpose indeed. Come on, she said, pulling away and taking his hand. There's something I want to show you.
Chapter 5. Obi-Wan Kenobi.
All the knowledge in the known galaxy lived in the Jedi archives. So researching Cato Ne Moidia should have been easy. But even though Obi-Wan sifted through details like topography, climate, planetary rotation, government structure, and cultural tendencies, none of that seemed to really provide any particular insight as to how he might convince the Trade Federation to accept a Jedi instead of Palpatine. Tutorials on speaking Pakpak, Republic-generated simulations using data obtained via clone intelligence, and a complete history of the Trade Federation were all part of his hours of study, yet he didn't feel any closer to actually discovering the insight that might break through prejudices on both sides. Methodically sifting through data would do as much good as sitting there worrying about Anakin. Instead, Obi-Wan tried a different tactic. A simple question that he'd relied on from time to time over the past decade, and perhaps not enough. How would Qui-Gon Jinn approach the Cato Ne Mordia situation? That led to him moving swiftly to the archive exit, Jocasta Nu barely acknowledging him, though her assistant, Noxie Kell, who had had an answer for every single question he'd presented, did offer a nod and a wave on his way out. A short time later, he arrived under the lit buildings of Coruscant's evening at the Coco District, heading straight toward an establishment that he'd last visited during a seemingly much more innocent time.
Don't you Jedi sleep?
Dexter Jetster's voice rang out from behind the counter even before Obi-Wan fully stepped into the empty diner, only a waitress droid rolling around to wipe the counters. Not when there's a war going on. Obi-Wan's boot squeaked on the still damp tiled floor. A war you started, by the way. The kitchen's double doors flew open as Dex squeezed through, blotches of sauce and grease stains in his shirt as his upper left hand draped a towel over his shoulder. Dex glanced around the space, then behind him.
Had to break it to you, but those clones were already there, whether or not you went to Kamino. No customers, huh?
No, which is good, because I need you to be discreet. A dart that looks like a children's toy is one thing. Obi-Wan.